Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, 2006. Today's session is entitled A Forum, What Gives You Hope and Stories of Hope, presented by Renita Falkenstein. Let's listen in.
Bothered him. And he started asking questions. What if we made a mistake? How are we, couldn't we be sure that guy was guilty? I just authorized the killing of someone. And he started asking questions. And then he asked his staff to study it. Study the death penalty. Look into all those cases, he said. I want to know about all 170. If I'm going to have to sign more death warrants, I want to know what I'm doing. And the more he looked into the death penalty, the more it made him doubt. And then he looked at the statistics. And in Illinois, since the death penalty was reinstated in 1977, we had executed 12 people at that time, which was in 2000, 2001, somewhere in there. And we had exonerated and found to be completely innocent 13 people. And all 13 of these people that we had exonerated and found to be completely innocent were people who had been tried, sentenced, gone through appeals, sentenced to death, gone through appeals. The wheels of justice had been had been grinding on for these people, and then DNA testing was done, and they were exonerated. They were innocent. And so Ryan is going, wait a minute. 13 of them were found to be innocent and 12 have been executed. There's something wrong with this picture. He said, it's like if Illinois was in the business of making parachutes and half of our parachutes worked. That's not good enough. You can't make parachutes and have only half of them work. So he decided to suspend executions until a more thorough study was done. So he suspended executions. And then the more study, the more he learned, the less he liked it. And then finally, 3 days before he went out of office, he decided it's no good. And he commuted the sentences to natural life in prison of 166 of those people. And he released and exonerated 4 of them and said, these people are innocent. And there might be others innocent among those 166, but at least we're not going to kill them. And one of the 4 was Leroy Orange, my client. So I got to go and buy a black turtleneck, a sport jacket, a tweed sport jacket, a pair of dress pants, some socks, some shoes, and a winter coat, because it was in the middle of January, for my client, and brought them to Cook County Jail, and went down the basement, and Leroy on one side of the bars, and me on the other side of the bars, we held hands and prayed, and we gave thanks, and we, for a whole day, there was a question whether it was really going to happen, if Leroy was going to really sign the exoneration, and at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they called him, he put on his clothes I had purchased for him. Every door Leroy had walked through for 19 years had condemned stamped on it. He was a condemned man. During the 19 years, of course, they had given him no education, no training, no nothing, because he was going to be executed. So why should we waste our money? But at the end of 19 years, they let him go. And my hope in that story comes with the fact that George Ryan was able to publicly change his mind. He could publicly change his mind, he could study something, learn, grow, and change. So that's mine.
Hey, I'm Jody Kretzman. I do community development, community building work across the United States and overseas, mostly in low-income and struggling communities. And the research that we do and the work that we do is almost all about trying to find and lift up hopeful stories in tough situations. So this is a pretty easy panel, and I'll talk for the next 8 days. I should also acknowledge that We were instructed that if we were on this panel tonight, we should note who isn't on it, and therefore the people in the room who might be hopeless, like Michael Pellett. So I want to make sure that Michael gets acknowledged as a hopeless person. Let me zero in on one aspect of what we find in community. Sometimes people think about the American people as a whole, as withdrawn people, as unfriendly people, as people who are in lots of ways afraid of the stranger. We've got a lot of fear in our culture right now. So the brief story, one of the things we're looking for constantly when we're looking for hope stories in tough situations is the kind of theme that Holden is so good at. Where do communities just exude hospitality? So I want to tell a brief hospitality story. One of the most powerful community organizations in my town in Chicago, Ingrid and I are from Chicago, is a group called the Logan Square Neighborhood Association. It's a neighborhood just northwest of the downtown Chicago. It's mostly Hispanic neighborhood, Puerto Rican, but a lot of Latinos from other countries as well. And it has a powerful community organization. And the organization had been pretty much concentrated on the usual things community organizations do: build affordable housing, make jobs happen, make the schools better, all the public issues that are critical in urban neighborhoods. They had a set of meetings a few years ago, and partly the meetings were, how are we doing in terms of including everybody in this good work that we're doing? Is everybody a part of it? And they decided, no, we're not doing very well here. We've got a wonderful remnant, you know, maybe 5, 6, 8% are involved, and that's pretty good in a neighborhood, but we could do better. So they decided that they would try to do some sort of intentional hospitality and inclusion. And they had a series of meetings in church basements. And the topic at the meetings in the neighborhood churches was always the same thing. And it was, who are the strangers here? And they made strangers lists in all the church basements. Who are the strangers? Well, it's the gang kids, or it's the old folks who are isolated, or it's the people who don't speak either English or Spanish. A whole lot of strangers appeared. But one group appeared on every list, and they sort of were designated as the strangest of the strangers. And who they were was the occupants of two big halfway houses in the community. People with disabilities who had been in institutions, and then when deinstitutionalization hit Illinois, as it did most states, they came back into the community, but they were isolated. They weren't integrated into the community at all. And what the neighborhood people were saying in the church basements is, look, we know they're here, but we don't know them at all. We have absolutely no idea who these people are. We see them walking through the neighborhood in groups to, you know, some kind of day activities, but we don't know who they are. So they decided to attack this problem of the strangest of the strangers. And what they did was, they hired a genius to lead the work. The genius was a woman named Rosita De La Rosa, Rose of the Rose. And Rosita was a person who had lived in this neighborhood her entire life. And she knew everybody, and everybody knew her. She was the first person in her family to ever graduate high school, so it's not that she had a high education. She just knew everybody. And the other thing that made Rosita a genius about this is that she could never, ever look at another human being without first seeing a whole array of gifts, a whole array of skills and talents and wonderful attributes. And so Rosita was the right person to do this job. And what she did was she began two sets of conversations. She had one set of conversations getting to know the people in these halfway houses, getting to know one by one, who are these folks? And the other set of conversations with people in the community, business people, daycare center people, all kinds of folks who are doing useful things in the community, political leaders. And she's looking for matches, right? She's looking for where can people come into the community based on their gifts and skills. So let me just tell you one quick story. She visited over and over again these two big, big houses. And in one of them, she noticed, after a couple of months of visiting, that there was always a guy over in the corner who was very, very quiet. And Rosita would always just go over and spend a couple minutes with him, and it turned out his name was Charlie, and introduce herself to him, talk a little. He would never say anything, but she'd always comment on something, the Cubs or the weather or something, and have some conversation but no response at all from Charlie. He was just completely shut down. One day when she went in to visit others who were talking with her, and she began to have some matches going on with others, Charlie all of a sudden got up from his chair, came over to Rosita, sort of took her arm, and led her toward the back of the house. And Rosita describes this with some trepidation, not knowing quite what was going to be happening here. Charlie was a guy that was about 55, 58 years old, maybe. And he was taking her back to his bedroom. And his bedroom turned out to be a stark, windowless, maybe 8x10 room with a bed and a chair and a chest of drawers. And Rosita was wondering, what in the world am I getting into? Why is this person taking me back to this room? And Charlie sits on the bed, Rosita sits on the chair, and Charlie still doesn't say anything at all. And Rosita starts looking around the room, and it's just a barren, barren room, except for one thing. On the top of the chest of drawers is clearly the center of the room. And it's a bowling ball mounted on a little mount, and it's polished. And Rosita looks at the bowling ball, and looks back at Charlie, looks at the bowling ball again, and asks a brilliant question. She said, "Charlie, do you like to bowl?" And Charlie all of a sudden just lit up, grinned from ear to ear, gets up off the bed, goes over, grabs the bowling ball, and puts it in Rosita's lap. Right? And Rosita knew that she had found a gift. And the gift could be the key to Charlie re-entering the community. So what does she do? She's a genius community builder. She goes to her cousin, who captains a team in the local Puerto Rican bowling league, right? And says to her cousin, "I've just met a new friend who loves to bowl. Do you have room for him on your team?" And her cousin looks at her like she's crazy and says, "No, we don't. It's the middle of the season. You should know better than to ask this." And so they do some negotiation. Community development is always about negotiation. And what happens is that Charlie finally is invited onto the team as the sixth member of a five-member bowling team. So he begins to come on league nights on Tuesday and Thursday and begins to bowl. And when he begins to bowl, it's clear that if he ever bowled in his life, it hadn't been for the last 30 years, right? Because everything goes into the gutter. And but slowly he gets a little bit better. And a little bit better after that, a little bit better. And those of you who bowl know that the leagues all run on handicaps. And he gets to the point where he's getting enough pins down, maybe averaging 50 or 60 a game, and he gets a handicap so that when one of the members of the team has to move to the suburbs and leave the team, Charlie gets invited on, and now he is officially a part of the Puerto Rican Bowling League. And he's coming every Tuesday and Thursday night. They accept him. They begin inviting him over to their houses, the members of the bowling team. He begins coming out of the halfway house more than twice a week. He begins to speak over a six-month kind of period. And what's interesting is that what comes out of his mouth is not English, but Spanish, because that's the language of the Puerto Rican bowling team. And he begins talking bowling lingo in Spanish. And then he begins to recall his childhood Polish, and then a little bit of his childhood English. And by the end of the year and a half, he is trilingual, speaking English and Polish and Spanish. You wouldn't want to have a deep philosophical conversation with him, but if it was simple enough, he could carry it. In the second year of bowling with this team, Charlie was named at the annual banquet of the Puerto Rican Bowling League Bowler of the Year and was lifted up as the award winner that year, and his team had won the championship as well. As he came back into life and back into community, it was discovered that bowling was not his only skill and talent, but that he was also a natural grandfather, and he began relating to the children of all of the people on the bowling team. And after about a year, he moved out of the halfway house and into a small apartment next to the family with the largest number of children and became a kind of live-in grandparent for a whole slew of kids in that community. And is now, still today, in his late 60s, a central figure in that part of Logan Square. There were about 45 stories like that of people who can't speak, or people who, when they speak, are not sure what's going to come out, or people who are confused about where they may be at a given time. And the community of Logan Square opened themselves up to these folks. And what's so evident when somebody like me from the outside of that neighborhood comes into that neighborhood is that you see people all over the place, in businesses and in nonprofit settings and in schools and on the street. And what you realize is you're the only person, you're outsider, you're the only person who notices. Everybody else takes them for granted, right? So I think there is a residual, my experience is, that there is a residual Holden-like hospitality in lots of communities in the United States, and that we never ask about it. We never activate it. We never put it into gear. And I get hopeful, not optimistic, but hopeful, there's a difference, every time I see more people beginning to tap into that latent hospitality.
My name is Bethany Mueller, and I currently serve Holden Village as one of the staff coordinators. And I'm going to speak about my experience working at a day center for the homeless in Tacoma, Washington, where I was for 2 years, first as a Lutheran volunteer and then as the program director. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the intersection of those two communities. I came to this day center for the homeless in Tacoma as right out of college, and it was founded in the early 80s by Jesuit priests who believed in a very radical mission of a ministry of presence, to not process people like numbers, to not necessarily look for results in the sense of who's getting into housing and who's getting clean, but who am I able to become a friend to? Who am I able to walk with? And let's establish that first before we worry about anything else. And I feel incredibly fortunate that I was able to land there sort of randomly. But Nativity House is the most welcoming place I've ever been in my entire life. I think most people do feel welcomed there. Our church services were the most profound experience for me. There's a room, huge room, probably about the size of the dining hall, well, maybe about two times the size of the dining hall, which has anywhere between 100 and 250 people in it. Busiest on the weekends, of course, busiest during meal times. And every Sunday after breakfast, one staff person stands up, never someone who's ordained, but still gives the elements and says all the things they're not supposed to say when they're not ordained. But a person stands up in front of the room and usually shouts, like, "We're going to have church now! Please, make your, like, please quiet your card games, and if you need to have a conversation, take it up to the smoking room or take a walk, but let this be a place for people to be at peace." And week after week after week after week, it was a place for people to be at peace. And I'd say about once a month, someone would approach me and say, would tell me that they came there to be a part of church at Nativity House, that they didn't feel a part of church anywhere else, but they would come there for church. And it looked nothing like a traditional church service. Some days they would take on sort of a support group feeling, with even though there were hundreds of people in the room, and someone would stand up and just start talking about their struggles. And oftentimes there were a lot of mentally ill folks in the room who would stand up and start talking about something. And more often than not, people allowed them that space, whether it went on for 10 minutes. So this is Nativity House. This is where I was. And I was able to come to Holden during my first year there in a partners in ministry opportunity. So I was able to come here for a week and retreat and relax. And I was sitting next to Janet Grant, a former director, and talking about Nativity House. And she said, "You should bring a group up here." I said, "Really? I didn't know that was a possibility." And she said, "Yeah, it's easy. You know, we do things like this a lot. Right, you know, send me a letter once you get out of the village." And within a number of weeks, we had found a time in September, and I knew I was going to be staying on at Nativity House, and I organized a group of five men to come to Holden Village in September. And these five different men had all been homeless for different reasons, very different reasons, varied racial backgrounds, varied life experiences. One was a illegal in the United States from Mexico. One had was just waiting until he turned 65 to collect his Social Security and just couldn't quite make it, so was living in his van for a couple of years before he turned 65. Lots of different stories for the five different men that were here. One was, you wouldn't know the first couple of days that you knew him that he was mentally ill, but after a while you started to realize that his reality was just quite a bit different, and it allowed him to function, but it didn't allow him to keep a job. So we came to Holden Village, we left Tacoma at 5 o'clock in the morning, we ate a lot of donuts, we came here, and we got out of the bus, and immediately everyone started filtering into their own space here at Holden. One morning I couldn't find one of the guys, and I looked into a Bible study, and here he was sitting, this 35-year-old Latino man sitting with like six women in their 70s at Bible study, and there, you know, one man was out on hikes every day, and one man that I want to talk about, Joe, found the lift, and the lift found him, and they were inseparable for the entire time that we were all here together. And one day I was with another one of the guys, and we were just taking a walk and looking around, and we heard this music coming out of the lift, and Joe was just playing the piano and playing and playing and playing like crazy. And we came in and we listened for a really long time and kind of started dancing a little bit with him, and it was all very spontaneous and free. And when the music was over and the dancing was over, Joe sat there very satisfied, and then he said, "This is the best moment of my life." And I believe him, because he here was able to find a lot of security and a lot of welcome. And our whole group really did. We ate our meals together, we shared meals together, everyone slept in a bed, everyone slept with a quilt on top of them every night. And on our way out, we were in the van and going back to Tacoma. And the same man, Joe, I asked the guys to just talk about, even though we've been talking all week, to talk about their experiences and things that they had to say, things we maybe hadn't fleshed out while they were here. And Joe said, "I felt more a part of something than I have, you know, since," I think he said, since he was in high school for about 20 years. He felt more a part of a community, that when he was here, he was able to feel a part of something larger than himself, and people didn't question who he was or where he came from, but he was just another guy in a session or at the piano or, you know, passing a tureen of soup. So that's a specific story, but my feeling of hope in general after my years working at Nativity House were just in relationships. I'm so thankful for the philosophy in that ministry of presence, because in that vulnerability and in that risk of not just calling someone, you know, not saying you have a relationship with someone, but you have a friendship, and that's risky and vulnerable and hurtful sometimes, I found so much hope and draw so much hope from that, those experiences still. So.
My name is Nelly from the Wanamaga, and I want to share with you a story from the time that I was the coordinator of a refugee agency in Cairo, Egypt, and that was partly sponsored by the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA. And when I was asked to come to Cairo, because the camps, there were a lot of refugee camps where the Somali, Ethiopian refugees in those days had gone in Sudan. The camps were in Sudan. And at one point, the United Nations decided that it was safe enough to go home, so they closed the camps. But a lot of people didn't feel comfortable to go home, so instead of going south, they went north and went up the Nile to Egypt. And so overnight, there was this huge community of refugees in Egypt, and nobody knew what to do with them. So the government asked the churches to set up an agency to help these people, because the government couldn't touch them because they were illegal. The United Nations couldn't touch them because it had decided they could go home. And so they asked if the churches and some of the non-governmental organizations wanted to start something. And then, I cannot go into that, but somehow the churches asked me to come and set that up. So I arrived in Cairo, and I was just in an ocean of people who all had terrible stories, awful stories of suffering. For example, one came to me and he said, "You know, I was a banker, and I have here the key of the bank, and that's all I've left. One day I suddenly was accused by the government, And my friends came and said, you either run now or you end up in jail and you'll be executed. Get out of here. So he said, all I could think of to take was the key. and so one after the other told us stories like that. And, you know, we were sitting there thinking, this is impossible. This is absolutely, there are no solutions here. We are foreigners in Egypt. These people are foreigners. And what can we do for them? Really, nothing. And so I went home and I was very depressed. And I ran into one of my friends who is a Coptic Orthodox Christian of the ancient Church of Egypt. And she said, you are running ahead of yourself. You have to take it step by step. And the first step is we'll sit down right now and we're starting to pray about this. And the second step is that you are going to phone everybody you know in Cairo and ask to start a prayer ministry and to pray with you. And then the third step is that you take these people one by one and you look what their gifts are. And you look what is this person, what can this person do with their life? Because each and every person is made in the sight of God and has a call. And the fact that they are here in Egypt as refugees doesn't mean that their call is lost. And so that's how we started. We started with prayer. We sat down and we started with prayer. And it was very strange. I cannot tell you about all the doors that opened, but I will tell you about two doors that opened. And one door opened in a very strange way. It opened by an extremely evangelical preacher who one day came to Cairo and preached to the refugees. And we were sitting in a room like this, and this was Cairo, and this preacher, he speaks very fast English. I couldn't even understand him, you know, we're not native speakers. We had no idea what the man was saying. And he was, you know, throwing around his quotes from the Bible, and all of a sudden the electricity is cut. So nobody hears anymore what he's saying in the microphone. He keeps talking. Yeah. At the end, the electricity comes back, and a few sentences later, he says, amen. And we all go home. By pure chance, a few weeks later, we get a letter that he sent to his communities where he tells the community that spontaneously that night, hundreds of refugees, the ones who were in the room together, had come to Christ. And a lot of these refugees were Muslims. And one of the refugees came to me and said, I read this letter and I feel very offended. What can we do? And he was a Muslim. And I said, why? I said, look, I'm not converting you, but why shall we both not be silent and pray and see what we can do? And we was, and each in our religion we prayed. And we prayed. And then we started to talk. We started, you know, almost over, it was not over ice cream, but we mentioned ice cream. And he said, you know what? People like this in the West, in these rich American churches, forget that one day I used to eat ice cream. I used to go out with my children and have a stroll. And that is how I learned he had six children. And then I said, can you write this down? Can you write down what you remember from your life in Ethiopia when you were, he was a businessman, when you were a businessman and when you still had the family together? And the next day he came to me with five stories. He had stayed up all night, and I realized this man is a writer. This man could write stories. It was amazing. And so what we did, we started to print out these stories and send them around. We sent them to all the churches we could, whose address we could get hold of. I mean, because, you know, I was not American. I didn't know the rules here and how things work. So in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, everywhere we sent these letters around. And we said, we have this problem. We are with these refugees here in Cairo. They think that their life is hopeless, but it is not, because we know God is in charge. And we want to give them hope. And can you help give them hope? And we are not asking for money. Whatever you can give to us, we will take. It doesn't matter. It can be your help. It can be a letter of support, anything. And the strange thing was that here all kinds of things started to come in. Someone came and said, I can teach people English. And another person came and said, I can help teaching English. And this teaching English ended up in a graduate in a program with graduation up to high school. And then people came and said, we'll open a clothing store for the refugees. And someone else said, I have this cousin in Cairo, she's very inventive. Why don't we ask her to help you set up a service to find work for these people? Now, coming back to this man, his name was Fuad. None of his children had finished school. So we put them in that program to study English and get math and. And after a while he came, this was 3 years later, and he said, wow, my children are doing so well. I'm feeling so liberated. And I thank this church for what it has done for me. It has made me a better Muslim, really. And I see now what God can do in our lives, because I thought God was dead for us. I just didn't know anymore where to turn. And I said, okay, where are we now and how do you see the rest of your life? He said, well, I must say, I do feel like a sitting duck. I feel I have much more qualities and talents than I can use. And so we said, okay, I'll go to cocktail parties and I'll find you a plane to a country. And that's what I did. I went to the cocktail parties of several embassies, and I started to network among the consuls, because one thing we never did was approach the embassies and say, can you take these refugees? Because officially that was forbidden. And it hadn't occurred to me that by networking I could make that happen, you know. So I bought some dresses and I went up the party circuit, and I found several consuls who were very engaged with the plight of the refugees, and several, it turned out, their house was cleaned by refugees. Through our work office, they had found cleaners. And they were very positive. They had very positive experiences. And they said, we will talk to our countries and see what we can do. And one day, I get a phone call from the Canadian consul saying, I have eight places on a plane, because eight of the official refugees have not shown up. It turns out they went to Australia instead. You know, these were unofficial refugees, and she could only handle official refugees. And she said, I wired Canada, and I got permission for eight unofficial refugees, the people you take care of. I said, that is our writer with his six children. His name is Fuad. And I said, can you take him? So I went to them in the middle of the night. I said, pack your bags. Tomorrow morning at 6, we'll be on a plane to Canada. Mm. And so they packed what they had. They went on the plane to Canada. And 3 years later, I went to visit them. Mm-hmm. He is now the head, or at that time, I'm not sure what he's now, but at that time, this was about 15 years ago, he was the boss of the translation section of the Vancouver police. And he said, and we were talking all night about how we had, you know, jumped into alleys to escape the police and escape all, everybody who looked official and as if they could arrest him, and where he was now. And this is just one story I can tell you of the many doors that opened, miracles that happened in the lives of people by indeed pointing out their talents, showing themselves that they had capacities. They were not dead while alive. There was still a whole world out there, and there were still children of God. And most of the people I worked with in that time, which was between 86 and 90, have now left. They have moved all over the world, and some have come back and become leaders of their communities, because at one point in Ethiopia you could go back. They have come back, and they are using the skills that they learned while in Cairo, and somehow this, you know, very much like all the stories I hear here, that what seemed totally impossible became possible, because we simply refused to give up hope.
Thank you. That's a nice spot to end this part. Thank you for being witnesses of peace and of hope and sharing that with all of us. So hopefully this giving you some time to think about stories of hope, however insignificant or large or humorous or serious you want. And I see one anxious person.
One thing I have to say, several years ago at Holden, we had the theme, which is for which every story here is part of the metaphor, summon out what we shall be, if that's the right word.
were talking, I thought of St. Paul's line that we are all, always be prepared to give account for the hope that is in you. Yeah, and I think that's what we are all called to do. We all have experiences of suffering and being overwhelmed at times as we turn on the news and, you know, as I mentioned, the things at the beginning of the evening that can weigh us down and that are like a burden that we carry. And so that's why I think it's good for us to share stories of hope among ourselves. And like, what gives you hope with your work or with some of these things like global climate change or in your family with struggles? Anything to help encourage one another, and because we need to hear each other's stories. Yes.
I'm serving a church in north side of Chicago, and it's a church that's created out of two congregations that came together, having to sell their buildings and close down as the congregations that they once were. One was 77 years old and the other was 97 years old. I happen to be part-time pastor at the 97-year-old congregation, and as you can imagine, it's a no small thing for a church to decide to close its doors and give up its name and combine with another congregation with all the unknowns that come along with that. And one night there was a council meeting in a few months leading up to this time of consolidation, and there was this one woman in particular who just recently finally has completed her GED, but she always had high native intelligence, but she never had enough certainty about herself. Her name was Elizabeth. And Elizabeth just was troubled about this whole idea of closing the building and deciding that that was something that we as a council could do. And two council members and I stayed up after an 11 o'clock council meeting another 3.5 hours just listening patiently with Elizabeth about all that was troubling her. And I guess the part that gave me hope about all that was not my part in it, but the two other lay people. The one gets up and has been at the Social Security Administration for 26 years now, and she usually gets up at 4:30 in the morning to start work by 6. And here she was, staying up until 2:30. And I thought, gosh, I don't have to get up that early in the morning. I don't know if I were not a volunteer person, would I be willing to stay up and listen for 3.5 more hours after the council meeting that was already 2 hours longer than normal? And then the other gentleman, he's worked down at the Board of Trade, and he does the recording of trades from the previous day that were called out verbally, but that have to be reconciled on paper. And he usually gets up at 5 in the morning and gets down there to start work at 6:30. So here were two laypersons who were sheerly exhausted. Elizabeth herself also got up at about 5:30 to get out to take the 2 or 3 buses that she had to go out to Skokie to her place of work from Rogers Park, north side of Chicago. So I guess for me the hope was that when you enter into unknowns, when you go there together, there's strength and hope in that hanging together, persisting in the most bleak and darkest doubts. The good news is that after that night, Elizabeth got to a point where she reckoned in her mind that if it was a church sale that was going to make way for a new public school to be built that would relieve the severe overcrowding up in Rogers Park that had been going on for 15 to 18 years, in her mind, she felt like the church was then still moving forward, not only with the consolidation, but with providing a way forward for the public school education in that neighborhood. But it took 3.5 extra hours for her to get to a point where she could think about that link and then go home and pray about it. And believe me, we prayed a lot that night. And it wasn't all in words. A lot of it was just sheer listening.
I just like to tell a story. My mom works with a group called Young Lives, and it's for teen moms. And a lot of these girls, like, I usually babysit for them and stuff, and so I get to know them, because most of them are my age and stuff, and they all have babies. And it's a really cool program, but most of these girls don't make the greatest decisions. And most of them drop out of high school. A lot of them, you know, just really don't do anything in their lives except for try to stay with the boyfriend or the father or get another one, and then they end up having another kid. And just a lot of these girls are really, like, just in their family situations, their parents, a lot of times have abused them or whatever, you know, and so their situations can be kind of crazy. But there's one girl that my mom works with a lot, and her name's Nicole, and she, like, her mom abused her when she was little, and she just has, like, the things that went on in her life when she was younger and that still go on in her life now are just crazy. And she had a baby. He's 1.5, so she had when she was 17. And, of course, the boyfriend left and is nowhere to be found. But, yeah, so, sorry. So her son is now 1.5 years old, and he is the sweetest little boy ever, and she is the most caring mother I have ever seen. Like, even moms who are, like, 28 and have a husband and everything, like, they don't, like, I've just never seen somebody who cares for her son as much. And she graduated high school. She has a job. She's going to college next year. She's going on a scholarship because she got a 4.0 in her high school. And it's just the coolest thing. And I just love hanging out with her. She's, like, such a great person. And I just love her to death. And it's just so cool to see that there is actual hope out there for, you know, these teen moms. Like, because a lot of them, it's kind of because of the way they've been raised. You know what I mean? A lot of it is and stuff. And the way she was raised was not any better. But she is such a strong person. And because of, like, the work that my mom and that other people do through Young Lives, like, she's been able to get the support she needs so she can go to college and stuff. Because when she's at college, we'll babysit for free, you know, and stuff like that. So it works out really well. It's just the coolest story. I just love it.
My father-in-law, after Katrina hit, went down as a volunteer coordinator for Lutheran Disaster Response. And so as a result of that, I went down there, not really that excited about going down, but I decided to, you know, go, give a week and go down and work on a house. And we were assigned one lady, her name was Miss Emma. She was an African-American lady who lost her house. Her house had probably 8 feet of water in it for 3 weeks, and her business as well, so she lost both. And so there was a group from our church cleaning her house out, and you know, she was very thankful. She came every day and was sitting there with, you know, talking to us and kind of meeting her, re-meeting her neighbors that were around. And the third day we were taking lunch break, and this young white lady came walking between the houses, came from the back, and we had seen very few people there. And this was 9 months after the hurricane, we asked, you know, what are you doing? And she says, well, I'm looking for my lawn furniture. And she looked like she was in total stunned, dazed. And turns out she lived right behind Miss Emma and knew her son, Miss Emma's son, but Miss Emma didn't know this lady. And they had just come back, her husband and her Shelly had just come back, and her husband was disabled, and she didn't know how she was going to be able to clean out her house. It was still, I mean, everything was a total disaster. And Miss Emma, this is a lady who had nothing. I mean, she was living in Dallas at the time and came down just while we were cleaning out her house. Starts ministering to this lady, and I mean, she's sobbing on her shoulder, and she says, don't worry, it'll be all right. And walks her back to her house, you know, with her crying the whole way, comforting her, and then she comes back with her later and says, here, Chris will take care of you, and gives her to me. Well, I basically looking for, you know, that we will help clean out her house. Well, I was leaving the next day, but through my father-in-law, we were able to get a group in there the next week to clean out her house. But the thing that really touched me was, here was a woman who had nothing, and she brought hope to me, and she brought hope to Michelle and her family. So, pretty moving experience.
I have to talk about myself in Poland. It might sound a little strange, but every word of it is really truly my story. And where do I start? I am a Northern European Lutheran, born and raised in Germany, and my parents are actually from the the very most northern part of Germany, and so that was always our tradition, and it's the kind of environment that is very unemotional. I mean, there you will not have an abundance of hugging and kissing there. And, life goes on, and then at some point, I can't really go into the details of that, but I had a major tragedy happening in my life in my early 20s, and what do you do, and not knowing where to turn. Also, as we have discussed a few times this week, European countries are de-churched, as Nelly said. Our family never thought about turning to a church as support. So what do? We turn inside and just close up, and on time goes, and it's not really a good situation because I get more and more angry over the years because I have no outlet for any of this. Coming to the States, I become a church secretary. You'd think I sit at the source, you know, of being able to work things out, and yet at the same time I kind of feel like I just go through the motions, sitting in worship, and I just cannot get this connection, and I have been getting more and more miserable over the years, and it's been literally up here at Holden that there was a crack in that wall. One of probably the prayers around the cross, where all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's okay to cry, I can do that. I can do this. I can just let go, and it happened. And ever since, you know, the different dancing and worship, dancing at all? Does anybody remember Jack the Village Dancer? I waved some kind of things. Probably the most ridiculous sight on the planet, and I had fun like I never had in my life before, and it wasn't overnight that I got better. I've been coming here almost every summer just for 2 weeks and looking forward to it, and just like my life depended on it in the way it did, because you know, I felt like I could be myself here, and this year I actually have made some major changes, and I'm just trying to, you know, accept the, you know, life as it is, and just accept it when I get emotional, not try to hide it, and I'm a so much happier person. I mean, it's like night and day, and I know it is because I have come up here, and the wonderful support I got here over the years as a very short-term step, so it's possible. And the many friends that I have on.
Thank you.
In summer of 2002, this is a story about, sometimes we at Holden, we get a little bit worried that this is a special place here, but what does it have to do with the rest of the world? And this is a little bit about that. In 2002, I did a presentation on a couple organizations that I'm involved in that support and do interventions around peace building in different conflict areas around the world, Bosnia, Rwanda, Sri Lanka, those kind of places. And I did a presentation on the work of this one organization that supports peace building work in Africa. And similar to Nelly's story, you know, I was involved in doing fundraising back home for a particular training that we were going to be doing in Cape Town that was scheduled for the next November. But I didn't really, I didn't put out any kind of major pitch or anything. But just talked about what the work was. And somewhere around, so this was like in July of 2002, somewhere around mid-September, I had a deadline of around September 15th to be able to have raised enough money to be able to put on the training in Cape Town, you know, a few months later. And it was the day of the deadline, and we were still significantly short. I mean, we raised, you know, some of the money, but just not enough to pull it off. And my secretary came up, the mail was delivered that morning, and I was literally picking up the phone to call my colleague who was making the decision about canceling this training that, you know, we had people coming from all over Africa to do. And my secretary comes up as I'm picking up the phone and says, "Rick, you got to look at this envelope." And she gives me this envelope, and there's a return address to a bank, a private bank in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I open the envelope, and there's this incredibly generous check inside that not only will close the gap and make sure that this workshop that we're about to cancel is going to happen, but actually provide some seed funding for some other stuff that we want to do. It was an anonymous gift, but I know it had to be a home gift because I don't know anybody. I'm from California. I don't know anybody from Minnesota except people that meet up here. I'm being straight with you. And the connection, the other part of the story is that, so at that training, a number of people participated. One, I just want to tell a story. One guy named Mateus, who is from Guinea, but also the northern part of Guinea, which is on the border with Senegal, where there's been one of a number of many civil wars for a number of years. And out of the training, Mateus, you know, moved from being mostly working in development work to doing more and more peace building work as part of his work in that West Africa region. And he sent me an email about, I guess it was spring of 2005, saying he had been trying for several months and finally had established a connection with some rebel leaders of a group in the Casamance region of southern Senegal. And he said, if I could find him some money, you know, to spend 4 or 5 months in the bush, to equip himself in the bush, he thought that, you know, they could make something, you know, change a dynamic that had been going on for 20 years. And so, you know, again, did my networking thing, got him what he needed. And, you know, 6 months later, you know, he would come out every 6 to 8 weeks and kind of say, well, this is what's happening, and maybe it's going to work, and no, it's not going very well. And then, but 6 months later, was able to get the rebel groups that were in that area to agree to come to the table with the government of Senegal and basically call a ceasefire. So, and subsequent to that, this organization, we've been doing work basically mediating that conflict, and that civil war is now over, and now they're doing the rebuilding. And Holden created that, because Mateus would not have been at this workshop if that person from Minnesota had somehow heard, and I've never been able to find out who that person was. So if you're in the room, thank you. I think that the story of hope is that we do have this illusion of being disconnected. You know, we see all these things going on around the world, and we say to ourselves, you know, we just feel so hopeless and powerless and disconnected from that. And this is just, like, I think, an example of how, you know, a talk at a session just like this, I mean, this is basically, it was in this room, you know, in the summer of 2002, led to the end of the Civil War in Senegal. So, you know, we are connected, and I think that remembering that is very important.
I've been coming to Holland for a long time, and I'm from Minnesota, and I'll be happy to take credit for it.
That's here for the gopher.
Well, I would like to... I don't know. Do you want to keep on going? We're out of time, but we should have a couple more. I think these are. I don't think anybody's really antsy to get going, right? So let's have a couple more here, and then we'll.
This is a really short one.
Okay.
But for me, I served a parish for 10 years. So a lot of amazing things happened. A lot of wonderful people I knew. One of the saddest experiences for me was also one of the most hopeful. A family with a beautiful, very talented daughter. All of a sudden, they saw that she started having seizures. Both her parents were physicians. and they had all the best medical help at Children's Orthopedic in Seattle, and they tested her and tested her. They couldn't figure out what was wrong. They ruled out one thing after another after another. I visited them at Children's Hospital. Their daughter was there for 5 months, and every day the parents were there for 5 months. At one point, the physicians put her into a coma, hoping that when she came out of the coma, maybe the seizures would stop. But they didn't, and little by little, this very bright, articulate 13-year-old gradually disintegrated before their eyes into someone who could hardly speak. And the disintegration was so slow that it was all the more painful as little by little they lost their daughter. And the mom, who I'll call Brenda, she and her husband as well became just, I don't know how they stuck, I don't know how they stood it. And lots of people from the congregation supported her and him. And one day I went to visit her, and there was something different in her eyes. And we went and talked and prayed together. And I said, something's different. And she said, I have felt so alone in all of this. She was not really a churchgoer. Her parents were. She was probably late 40s, but she started coming to the church when her daughter was up. And she said, I have felt so alone in all of this, and as if all of you who come visit me have faith, and I don't have anything. I just love my daughter and feel like I'm dying with her. And she said, this afternoon, I took a picture of my daughter, and I just looked at it. She was in the chapel in the hospital, and I wept and wept and wept. And she said, suddenly I took a deep breath, and I realized that I wasn't alone. She said, I realized that God looks at me with as much love as I look at my daughter. And she said, I've never believed that there was a God, or that God loved me. And she said, but finally a light opened in my spirit, and I realized that God looks at me with as much love as I look at my daughter. And she said, I have hope now. And she said, it's not hope that my daughter will get better, but she said, I have hope. And the end of the story is that 4 years later, a genetic test was discovered which named exactly what the daughter had, and they now know what it is, know that it's genetic, and know that she may have 4 to 8 years at most to live. But I've seen a change in her face since that afternoon. Someone believed that they were loved by God, and they never thought they were.
When my mother turned 80, my family decided that to celebrate that, we were going to go on a cruise, something I'd never done before. So we went on this cruise, and the first night out, the ship hit a reef and started to sink. So this was a major cruise line, and they put a 60-foot hole in the bottom of the boat. And so we were all evacuated, my 80-year-old mother, 35 members of my family. We went on to the island of St. Martin, and it was Christmas time, no hotel rooms. And so they kept trying to find places for us, and for my family, they put us in a soup kitchen in one part of town. And so for 2 nights, we slept on the tables or on the floor. We didn't have maps, didn't have anything. And we found out later that the Red Cross didn't know where we were, and they were in charge of this. But the people in the soup kitchen were so kind to us. There were these women in the kitchen who were making food for the poor who would come every day into this facility. And so picture our, you know, white upper middle class people from going from the cruise ship into the soup kitchen. Well, to make it short, we eventually got home the next year because they'd given us free tickets. We decided we'd do it again. So when we landed on this island safely, I thought, well, I'm going to go over there and thank these people. Soup kitchen. So I walked into the kitchen. The facility wasn't open yet, but I went in the back door. And here were the same two black women making soup. And I had come to do the right thing. I walked up to them and I said, you probably don't remember me, but I was on that cruise ship last year that sank, and I came back to thank you. And this one woman took my hands in hers
And she held them tight. She just looked at me and said, God is good. God is good. And I said, yeah, he is good. But see, I've come back, thank you. And she just kept hanging on my hands and said, no, no, God is good. God is good. Yeah, he's good, but you see, you know, until I finally shut up. She gave me something I will never forget. For the first time in my life, I did understand that God was good. I'd always said, you know, I'd always hoped it was so. But for the first time, I walked away from there in a daze. Because I understood that someone else had given me this fabulous gift of the knowledge of the goodness of God. And if that should happen to be true, then the light does shine in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And if that is true, then there is hope.
It's been a rich banquet, just sitting here and hearing all of these stories, one after another. And all of you are witnesses to hope, and I encourage you to continue to share these stories, knowing that the Spirit is at work, and that there's in the world transforming us and giving us hope. And I'd like to ask Joshua to lead us, close the session with a song, and I think talking about the source of our hope, and I think there's some parts for us to be involved too, right, Joshua?
Where should I be?
It's about 5 to 10. Yeah, you're welcome to stay for Vespers right after this. I completely forgot about it. My apologies. This could be the closing of the session and the beginning of Vespers if you want to think of it that way.
Just gonna stand up.
Oh, you can
stand up. A little more comfortable for me. Thank you. We need to ask me to. She asked me to play a song that I wish I wrote. It's by a woman named Iris Dement, and she's a progressive Christian hillbilly, if you will. And I heard this song on someone's CD player one day. And I couldn't quite hear the words, but I knew that there was something going on in the words, and there was a story being told that I wanted to hear. So I got the CD from a friend who got the lyrics, and lo and behold, there was a story that I want to share with you today.
Right there on.
over the amount that was due. If you need more, he said, I'm good for that too. He reached down, he reached down, touched the man. He reached down, he reached down, touched the man. Well, then the scribes and the Pharisees brought the adulteress in for Jesus to see. Lord, she sinned, and the law says she must be stoned. Well, if there's a one of you without sin, he said you can cast the first stone in. One by one they left, leaving Jesus and the woman alone. He reached down, he reached down, right there on the ground. He reached down, he reached down to touch the pain. No accusers are left that I see. Woman, neither do I condemn thee. He reached down, he reached down, touched the pain. He reached down, right there on the ground. He reached down, touched the pain. In the book, a little story is told about a traveler at the end of life's road. He's at the gates of the kingdom, and the master says, come on in. For I was hungry, and you gave me meat. I was cold, you put shoes on my feet. When I was in prison, it was you who came to see about me. You reached down, you reached down, right there on the ground. You reached down. When you did it to the least of these, you are doing it unto me. You reach down, you reach down, touch the pain. You reach down, you reach down, right there on the ground. You reach down, you reach down, touch the pain. You reach down, you reach down, right there. On the ground, you reach down, you reach down, touch the pain. You reach down, right there on the ground. You reach down, you reach down, touch.